The number of incarcerated women has increased dramatically since 1980, and the pathway to exoneration for wrongfully convicted women is different and more daunting than for men. Two attorneys with the Ohio Innocence Project have been analyzing data to understand why so few wrongfully convicted women make it through the application process to seek help. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss why this is are Ohio Innocence Project staff attorneys Lauren Staley and Kate Flexter. Thanks for being here, Lauren and Kate.
Thanks for having us.
And Director of Research for the Sentencing Project, Nazgul Gannouche. Thank you all so much for being here. Thank you for joining us, Nazgul.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Nazgul, there are still many more men who are incarcerated in the United States than women, but the women's prison population has been growing. How fast has it been growing?
So currently, I say currently, but the most recent year of data that we have for national figures is 2023. And in that year, there were 186,000 women incarcerated nationwide in state prisons, in local jails, and in federal facilities. So 186,000. That compares to in 1980, there were 26,000 women incarcerated nationwide. So that's a really dramatic increase over that period of time, over 600% growth.
Wow, over 600% growth. What are some of the reasons behind that growth?
Some of them overlap a lot with the reasons that we've had a dramatic increase in incarceration for men as well. So that includes the fact that during part of that period, crime rates were going up until the mid-1990s. There were higher rates of violent crime and property crime around the country, and that partly drove up incarceration rates, but it played a relatively small part because what actually had much more of an impact was policymakers' overreaction to that uptick in crime. So during that era, sentence lengths dramatically increased. So whereas someone might have gone to prison for a year let's say, a burglary offense or, you know, 2 or 3 years, that became a much longer sentence once someone was imprisoned and sentenced. Another reason is that the likelihood of going to prison dramatically increased. So if someone had a drug conviction, whereas in the past we would have been more likely to see that that individual would not experience incarceration, they became much more likely to experience incarceration. So that's the overlap in reasons for men and women. And then for women, it's important to consider also that a lot of folks don't realize that most men that are in prison are there for a violent conviction as their most serious offense. And so that includes crimes like a serious assault, a sexual violence, homicide. But for women, it's much more likely that they're in prison for a nonviolent offense, like a drug conviction or a property conviction. And part of the failure in our society of being able to treat people who have substance use problems is a factor that leads women to be more likely to experience incarceration for nonviolent offenses.
Mm. Well, Lauren, my understanding is that while the number of incarcerated women has been growing, a very small percentage of people who are exonerated for their crimes are women, right? Can you walk us through that?
Yes. So nationally, there's only about 323 women who have been exonerated in the U.S., at least since that we started tracking that data in 1989. And that's compared to like nearly 3,500 men. So there's a huge disparity. We at the Ohio Innocence Project have 43 exonerees, only one of whom is a woman. So internally, we really wanted to look at what was going on, both in terms of the bigger picture of what makes it harder for to find female exonerees, to exonerate those in those cases, but also whether there was anything internally in our internal processes that could be affecting that or that we could do to improve the number of applicants we got.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that a little bit later. But I read that 73% of women exonerated were convicted of crimes that never occurred. Mm-hmm. Can you what does that even mean? What are these crimes that never occurred? Kate, I don't know if you can talk about that.
Sure. So those are no crime crimes. It's simply like the best example I can give is shaken baby syndrome. It's a situation where they believe a child was abused. Someone is convicted of abusing the child. But in reality, the child died of natural causes. So that's something that we see. And they're a lot harder to litigate and to overcome in post-conviction litigation, because it's not a situation where you do a DNA test, you can point to the other person who did it and say, here's the real perpetrator. Instead, you're actually saying, hey, nothing happened here. There was no crime. So those are significantly harder to overcome. I was just going to add, too, that we also have women are rarely convicted of crimes or exonerated based on DNA. There are only 15 women in the U.S. who have been exonerated based on DNA. And often we see that these are child victims. So those are just some factors that make it particularly difficult to overcome, wrongful convictions of women.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned shaken baby syndrome, and I think a lot of our listeners will be thinking, but hey, there are people out there who abuse children and, you know, do terrible things to them and are convicted rightfully for that. So we're not talking about those people. Were, I just want to clarify that.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. Yes, absolutely. There are, the vast majority of these cases, abuse occurred. We're talking about this really niche situation where a child might have died from natural causes, and there can be situations of misdiagnosis. So mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about. I guess another example would be the satanic panic. That was something that went on where no crime occurred. Those are the types of situations impacting women.
Yeah. Can one of you talk a little bit more about the satanic panic for folks who don't understand, remember that reference?
Sure. So, I mean, my understanding is, 90s, 80s, late 80s, early 90s, it was allegations of sort of satanic ritual, sexual crimes often that occurred, and it disproportionately impacted women. Nancy Smith is one of our exonerees. Her case sort of ventures into that land as well.
Hmm. Okay. And what, many women in the U.S. are caretakers in their families. How does that caretaker role figure into these convictions?
Yeah, absolutely. When we look at shaken baby syndrome as an example, women are often in caretaker roles, at least historically. I know that's shifted some over the years. And being in the caretaker role means that you're the person who was last with the child. You are the person who will be accused in those situations. And so, absolutely. Another thing that comes into play is sort of our traditional understanding of women in their gender roles. I'm thinking of a documentary, Southwest of Salem, where they talk about it was women who were gay, and they were going after them, wrongfully convicted because of that. So it's when women aren't conforming to your idea of how they should fit into society.
Hmm. There are also additional pressures, I think, when women are in caretaker roles pre-trial. So if they are locked up, being held while their charges are pending, those types of pressures, they could lose their children while they're incarcerated. If they're the primary or sole caregiver, can impact maybe the pressure to plead guilty, even if they're innocent,
or just to end the process.
Mm-hmm. OIP has one client who is a woman and was in that position and didn't want to waive speedy trial time to try to expedite the process. And that can have impacts on, the ability to prepare a defense for trial.
Sure. It can take time to gather that evidence, figure out who the best witnesses are. Well, we're talking about the growing number of incarcerated women and why exoneration is more difficult for wrongly convicted women than men. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Nazgul, in the Sentencing Project's latest report on incarcerated women and girls, I saw that Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio all have rates of female imprisonment higher than the national average. Can you talk about some of the reasons behind state variations in those rates?
It has to do partly with sentencing laws in those states and with prosecutorial discretion. So how often when prosecutors are a case comes before them, they in plea bargaining, they're relying on incarceration rather than a community supervision sentence, for example. Those are some of the factors.
Okay. Well, so we have this higher than average rate of incarcerated women in Ohio. You all focus on Ohio, Kate and Lauren, so I'm not going to quiz you about Indiana and Kentucky. Does that mean that a growing number of women are getting help through the Ohio Innocence Project?
That's something we would hope for and something that we were striving for, which is why we started to kind of dig into our application process to try to better understand how we could get people to apply. Because we thought there were probably, this is just sort of the tip of the iceberg, there are a lot of women who should apply to us and might not know that they have a good innocence claim.
Okay. Well, we will talk more about your analysis after a quick break. And later in the program, does homeowners insurance have your back when you need it? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about the growing number of incarcerated women and why exoneration can be even more difficult for wrongfully convicted women than for men. My guests are Director of Research for the Sentencing Project, Nazgul Gannouche, and Ohio Innocence Project staff attorneys Lauren Staley and Kate Flexter. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So before our break, Kate, you mentioned that, you know, you all started looking at why more women weren't applying for help. Can one of you talk about what you found in digging through that information, analyzing that data?
Sure. So we were noticing anecdotally that it seemed like women weren't returning applications to our project at the same rate. So just a quick overview, when somebody writes in for assistance to the Ohio Innocence Project, they'll write us a letter and then we mail them an application. And we noticed that it seemed like women weren't returning those applications as much. We were aware of some of the research being done in the corporate world about job applications and gender response rates. So I think it was Hewlett-Packard had a study that where they found that 60% of men will tend to apply for jobs if they meet 60% of the listed qualifications, whereas women are more likely to not apply unless they meet every single listed qualification, 100%. And there was a LinkedIn study as well that showed that women were 16% less likely to apply for a job that they viewed than men. After viewing it. So we're seeing this phenomenon potentially of women who are self-selecting out, not applying for jobs that they're interested in because they don't think that they're qualified. And we were curious whether that same phenomenon might be happening with our own applications. So we looked at the data, and when we looked initially at our application data over 20-plus year period, the general average, there wasn't actually that much difference between men and women. But once we started digging year to year, we found something really interesting.
Yeah, we found that when we were sending follow-up letters, that women were more likely to respond, significantly more likely to respond. Men and women, but significantly more for women. And so that's something we've started to do, just these little tweaks that might make a woman more likely to apply. So we don't want them to self-select out. We want to be the ones who are making that decision, just because I think we're better positioned to make those decisions. And so we're just making these little tweaks based on, you know, psychology and things like that to get applicants.
Sure. So it's after you send that initial letter, it's also, hey, we haven't heard back from you. Have you thought about whether this might be a possibility for you?
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Well, and you referenced this earlier, Kate, but we talked about this large number of women who have been exonerated, who were convicted of crimes that didn't actually occur. And when you're dealing in an innocence project with somebody who's been convicted, you've got to prove their innocence rather than their guilt. So how hard is it to prove innocence in a crime that didn't occur?
I think it's particularly difficult because you're not just saying, like I said, here's the person who actually did it. You're saying no crime even occurred here. And I think that's a very it's not a palatable narrative for a judge or for a jury to say, hey, we got it wrong here. We need to correct this, especially when there's, a child victim. Understandably, people want to see some closure there. Mm-hmm. So it's particularly difficult. Yes.
Yeah. Well, another instance that I've read about is women are more likely to be convicted for killing a partner who's abused them, and they're less successful using stand your ground laws that mm-hmm. so many states have, less successful than men are. Can one of you speak to that a little bit?
I think it's a difficult situation because there is this need to expand our understanding of self-defense to accommodate these situations. And I think the legal community is starting to recognize that, but the laws haven't necessarily caught up. So these state self-defense laws are really narrow and don't always allow for these kinds of battered women defenses to be raised.
And there are rumblings kind of within the Innocence Network at large about the concept of expanding the definition of innocence. There's no legal framework in Ohio to raise those types of claims right now, but it's sort of like a dream that maybe we would be able to do that one day.
Hmm. Well,
one trend, if I may jump in.
Oh, please do.
One trend that we've seen at the Sentencing Project and have been supporting in several states is the passage of Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act laws, so DVSJA laws. New York State has a legislation like this, and in the past couple of years, some southern states, including Oklahoma and Georgia, have passed legislation that allows for women, actually anybody, who is incarcerated and their offense is a product of domestic violence to repetition the courts for a review of their sentences. And so we're very excited about that movement because 1 in 11 women in prison is serving a life sentence. Typically, those extreme sentences are for homicide offenses. And when researchers talk to women serving sentences like that, they generally find that a lot of these women experienced a serious amount of trauma leading up to their crime, a significant amount of violence in their relationships, if it was a intimate partner killing. And so having an opportunity to have a second look at cases like this is really important to assess whether these women should still be incarcerated.
So, Nazgul, is the idea behind those laws that you just referenced and strengthening or expanding self-defense laws, as Kate and Lauren were talking about, is the idea there that there would, if those laws were in place or expanded, there would not be a conviction to begin with? I mean, the women wouldn't be convicted of those crimes. Is that kind of the idea?
Ideally, we would get, the criminal legal system would get things right the first time and not convict people who shouldn't be convicted or adjust their sentence if they committed an act of violence where there was some kind of justification. But a lot of the movement right now in sentencing reform is to at least look at the second chance that someone should receive. So, given that there's so many people incarcerated serving life sentences, over 200,000 nationwide just serving life sentences, there's a real need to both get it right the first time, but to recognize that we haven't gotten it right the first time for a lot of people. And so we really need mechanisms to reassess.
Hmm. Kate, you mentioned earlier that the Ohio Innocence Project has tweaked some of its practices, sending these follow-up letters. Are there any other changes you all have made or are considering to try to make sure you're reaching everyone you need to be reaching?
We are considering doing more active outreach, which could include going to prisons to talk to people. That's logistically really difficult. They're very restrictive about how you get in and who gets in and all of that. Another thing that we've thought about is sort of having a more tailored application for cases like shaken baby syndrome, because we've noticed that some of our questions might inhibit someone from applying. When we say, were you there when the crime was committed? For someone in a no-crime situation, it can be very difficult to decide whether or not they were there. Yes, they were there when their child fell ill, but they might, you know, not know exactly how to answer that question.
Interesting. Naskal, what do you think are the broader social implications of having this growing number of women and girls behind bars?
For women, it's especially obvious that incarceration affects more than the individual that's behind bars. Given that the majority of women, roughly 62%, who are incarcerated have a child under the age of 18, that means that that connection, that home is being disrupted while the person is incarcerated. And so it really speaks to, and I should add that that disproportionately happens for women of color. We've made a lot of progress in the past decade or so in reducing racial disparities in incarceration, especially for women, but they still exist. And so it really speaks to the need of figuring out what are some of the sources, the needs that women have that result in when crimes do happen in that offense, when it's a drug problem, how can we expand access to drug treatment? If it's a mental health situation, how can we make sure that people have insurance coverage to get mental health care? If it's a domestic violence situation, what are some of the interventions that we can put in place to protect women and prevent crimes from happening in the first place?
Kate or Lauren, do you think the changes you're making at the Ohio Innocence Project could have an impact beyond Ohio? Are you talking with other Innocence Projects in other places about your findings?
We are. Kate and I actually presented on our preliminary research at the National Innocence Network Conference in April, and that started a lot of conversations with representatives from other projects. We've been collaborating with the director of the West Virginia Innocence Project to try to expand some of our data and then, you know, have a little more information to act on, at least regionally. But there was a lot of interest in the conversation, and I think a lot of people were experiencing similar things in their own projects.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Innocence Project staff attorneys Lauren Staley and Kate Flexter, and Director of Research for the Sentencing Project, Naskal Gannouche. Thank you all so much for your time today. It's been a really important conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, does it actually pay to have homeowners insurance when you need it most? This is Cincinnati Edition.